How's it, everyone? This is Nate. I get to welcome you to the podcast and tell you about our sponsor for today, which is Oakley Standard Issue. Oakley Standard Issue is a division of Oakley specifically for serving those that serve government, military, law enforcement, firefighters, and EMS, the whole lot. Qualified members are going to get exclusive access to new products, service-related discounts, that's the big one, but a whole lot more. Products they're probably already known for is the eyewear. Their eyewear is ballistic rated and industrial certified, perfect for on the job. Footwear that meets uniform regulations while on duty, which is kind of a big deal. Some of my favorite boots I've ever had are the Oakley boots that I picked up when I was in Fort Bliss doing a ton of ruck marches there. Other accessories like gloves and backpacks, some of my favorite gloves I've ever had have also been Oakley gloves. Newly released off-duty styles and collections are definitely stuff that you want to head over and check out. Head on over to oakleysi.com to register. Then you can take advantage of our discount code, which is fieldcraft15 at checkout to receive an additional 15% off of your first order. Again, that is oakleysi, Sierra India.com. Built to protect. Make sure you head on over and check that out.
Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I am your highly caffeinated host for this episode. I am here in Nashville, Tennessee, and I will tell you that I'm at the Street Cop Conference, and Glover sent me here along with a few other Fieldcraft folks, and he was like, hey, bring the podcast equipment. I want you to interview guys that are pretty interesting. So let me kind of set the stage for you. Street Cop is a conference with well over 1,000 men and women, law enforcement from all over the country. And it meets once a year to discuss like best practices for law enforcement. And it's been really eye-opening to kind of hear a lot of these different guests. Now, we set up a booth there, Casey, John, and myself. And of course, our booth with like, without the feminine touch, our booth looked like garbage until Casey's, you know, lovely wife showed up and she made everything nice, like really, really nice. And I don't know if it was, you know, the feng shui or whatever you want to call it of the table or Erica being out there and doing the female thing, but we sold a lot because of her. So shout out to Mrs. Kentucky, Erica, you're a sweetheart. Thank you for taking care of us. Well, all right, let me get back to not being super caffeinated and explain who's with us today. So sometime around noon today, maybe a little bit earlier, a gentleman walks up and we start talking and, you know, we start looking at different items on the table and he's being highly critical of our medical gear. And he's like, oh, I'm glad you chose the purple gloves here. You know, when you do a blood sweep, you know, you got to be able to see the blood. I'm like, that's spot on. You know, Jerry talks about that and Doc talks about that. And, you know, we start talking. Next thing you know, he's telling me that he's involved with Street Cop and he's one of the medics and he, you know, has spoken to the convention before. And since then, we've had a few interesting stories along on the drive back. And I think you guys are going to enjoy some of the stories about Street Cop, about what this gentleman does, maybe about where we are today. Right now, we're not in an official podcast studio. So if you hear like rattling, it might be the air conditioner. It might be the duct tape looking couch that we're looking at. It might be the crystal chandelier overhead. It's a very surreal place where we're doing this recording. So guys, that's like the longest, most unnecessary introduction I've ever done as a podcast host. But without further ado, Sean Barnett.
Hello.
How are you, sir?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me yeah, today.
Thanks for joining us in our car, our rental truck that doesn't look sketchy at all with a random tarp over the back. You said, is this a rental vehicle? And you were like, yeah, of course it is. And you didn't even ask where we're going. You just trusted, you know, myself and John and, you know,
always down for an adventure.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, and I get a funny feeling that if something bad did happen to you, there's only a room of about 1,000 cops that would be like, where is he? Right?
Maybe so.
Yeah, exactly.
One can hope.
So let's talk about Street Cop because I never heard of this before, like maybe 3 weeks ago. And Mike was like, you're going. What is Street Cop all about?
So Street Cop was brought brought to bear by Dennis Bonino out of New Jersey. And he's done a phenomenal job because he recognized that there was a need for quality training. We talked in the car about quality versus quantity. Mm-hmm. Cops don't like to be read to all day, you know, looking at PowerPoint presentations and being read to. And nobody likes that, you know, no matter what field you're in. I'm in the medical field. You know, Dennis is in a police field, that sort of thing. Any field you're in, you don't want to be read to all day. So Dennis saw that need. And he saw that cops were being killed unnecessarily for stupid old police practices. He talks a lot about, as an example, you know, you get pulled over by a police officer and typically the police officer will approach on the driver's side, which exposes the officer to being injured by passing motorists. And mm-hmm. so he talks a lot, it's just one example of so many, doing a passenger side approach. It's a lot safer. It's a lot safer from being hit or struck by the motoring public. It's a lot safer from an officer safety perspective because you can see into the vehicle a lot better. And the motorist, you know, whoever you're pulling over, expects you to be on the left side. Right. So you have the element of surprise a little bit there as well. So that's one example. So Dennis formulated this proactive patrol tactics. That's Dennis's class. And I started in New Jersey and he did the class and it just took off like wildfire. And so as Dennis progressed the company, he realized, hey, we could add these other instructors. And so he has so many great instructors now that have come on board. A lot of interdiction instructors. We have people doing and all these people are experts. And that's the cool thing about street cop training. I think that's, you know, there's so many training agencies out there. I think what sets street cop apart is the quality, again, mm-hmm. of the instructors that. And what makes them quality is they love it. They're so passionate about it and they believe in it and they want to help. I mean, we field calls. Every one of us has given our or will give our phone numbers out, our personal cell phone numbers to 1,500 cops this week.
Right.
And some people say, oh, you're crazy for doing that. Well, and the fact is, if some cop needs help, I'm absolutely going to help them. That's what I'm here for. You know, we're all in the service field and we want to serve these officers. They deserve it. They deserve quality training. And it's been a huge hit.
Yeah, Dennis is an interesting character. We met him yesterday and he was larger than life when we met him. And I mean, I don't even want to go into the details of some of the stories, but John was there with me and Casey was there with me. And when he left, we were like, that was a tornado that just flew through here. And we're like, I need to write down some of those one-liners because he is very animated. But you said it in the vehicle on the way over here. He's incredibly passionate. Yes. And today, you know, where we were set up in the vendor alley, we overhear all of the speakers, right? And we actually propped open the blind so we could see the speakers. Mm-hmm. And Dennis said that he originally had slated, 90 minutes for his talk, but then yes. he only gave himself 45. And in that 45 minutes, he said one of the practices that really drives him crazy is the concept of putting a thumbprint on the back of the vehicle. And he's yes. like, well, you know, you're taught this from a lot of the longstanding cops. And he's like, it's because if you ever, if that vehicle is ever involved in a crime, whether, you know, the occupant shot at the cop, injured the cop, there's DNA on the vehicle, there's a right. fingerprint on the vehicle, this and that. And he's saying, you know, how many people heard that? And I think everyone raised their hand in the room. And then he said, how many times has it actually been used in a trial? And he's like, zero. And
right.
And that type of thing, it was very interesting because I've heard that. I'm not a cop. You know, I've got right. cop buddies, but I've heard people say, well, yeah, you touch the vehicle, so you leave your fingerprint on there, or, you know, you check the trunk or whatever. And then the important message that he drove home was the why, yes. right? Like, it's not just what you're doing, but why do you do that? And, you know, it all gets traced back to, as he said today, prohibition, which was really, really interesting to hear. Like, that's been around for, I mean, prohibition was in the 20s. We're talking 100 years.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like a 100-year-old right. practice. So I like the idea that it's an evolution of training, right? It evolves with the current practices. There's Case coming down. By the way, guys, if you randomly hear Casey or John in the background, I mean, that's the nature of doing a podcast on the road. So don't worry. It's just Casey. Casey is our resident director of tactical training. So you're getting a little bonus. But yeah, the whole idea of Street Cop, I thought was really cool. And looking at the guest list, I was blown away. I was like, oh my God, they got that guy and that guy and that guy. And it's, mm-hmm. you know, watching the police line up for autographs or pictures. You know, I'm going to try to get Tommy Lahren on the podcast at some point. And you said that she was just a genuine person. So
yes.
Tommy, if you hear this and if whatever reason you can't make it on the podcast, I still want you on the podcast. But my gosh, what a cool conference.
Yeah. Well, and like Dennis says, you know, his whole point is to bring as much value to this conference for these officers as he possibly can. And you know, for if there are any officers listening, there's so much free stuff that Dennis gives out, you know, the reasonable articulation, the RAS checklist, you know, that's free, you know, and I had a field training officer tell me, I wish I had this a year ago when I had my training, because I would have just printed off a copy and been way ahead of the game. And that's free on our Facebook page. I mean, you sign up and you click in the files section and boom, there it's downloaded. And every instructor we put out, you know, I put out a Medical Monday article as an example, to the Street Cop page. And, you know, I do all sorts of different articles. You brought up the glove thing. And so I do a whole article about, here's why I believe that you should have quality medical gloves. That seems such a silly thing to talk about until you think about, wow, we don't want medical gloves that just break, because it breaks your attention. Like we talked about earlier, you want to be able to see blood on gloves. You know, we don't need the black tactical, you know, oh, I got to look, what if somebody sees me in the darkness wearing black, you know,
right.
That's so, again, it goes back to the thumbprint thing. When is in the history of anything tactical, I mean, I'm sure you know several special operations people, they don't wear black tactical gloves. They wear the Coyote Brown, or they wear the ones I mentioned, you know, that are the EC exam. I know that's a very silly thing to talk about, but if you dive into having the quality, if I'm going to be that quality about that particular detail, think about everything else that, you know, we tried to expand upon.
Yeah. The whole idea of that divided attention gets people killed, right? I mean, that's how magicians are able to pull people into this concept of, you know, sleight of hand and how they're able to do these illusions. Mm-hmm. It's like, look over here, look over here, look over here. And then they pull off the magic elsewhere.
Absolutely.
You know, that divided attention, the devil is in the details. Mm-hmm. And if you were to have, say, 5 minutes to assemble something and you didn't think about all the little details, well, after that 5 minutes, you then apply, you know, the thought process, okay, why did I choose this? And then you have a chance to analyze it. And if you're given another 5 minutes, you'll make it better and better. Mm-hmm. What I think is really interesting is there are many people, whether it's driver's ed or police training or teacher training, that's my background, like people are content saying, I learned this 10 years ago and that's what I'm doing. You know, it's 10 years ago, but that continuing education component, unless there's an incentive like, well, the department is paying for us to go, right? People will say, I don't want to train unless I'm getting paid to train. And it's like, you don't understand that people will pay to train because the value is it keeps you alive and your life is worth way more than, say, a $300 class or a $700 seminar or whatever it may be. That is, I think, a cancer in the training world, is where people will say, oh, if I'm not getting paid or if it's not free, I'm not doing it. Or that's too much. But it's like, you may learn even a fundamental skill, and that fundamental changes everything in how you do it. And guess what? That the value there is far more than what the cost of the course is.
I absolutely agree with you. And the interesting thing you brought up is mindset. I mean, it's all about a mindset. I put out an article the other day about four things every officer should carry on them, on their person. You know, cops everywhere, they're like, oh, well, gosh, Sean, I have this really cool medical bag, like, and it sits in my patrol car. And I'm like, that's really great, until you have to run back to your patrol car, to wherever that may be, to retrieve the items, to go run back to the person that's hurt, or even yourself. What are you going to do if you're hurt?
Right.
And so anyway, I did the four things that every officer should carry on them, on their person. And
which are,
I said, Raptor trauma shears, a COT CCC approved tourniquet, or I'm sorry, recommended tourniquet is the correct term. And there are, let me just go off on a little tangent.
Yeah. Fire away. Go ahead.
So tourniquets, if you are not purchasing and using something that's recommended by the Committee of Tactical Combat Casualty Care, I will just say it, you're wrong. You should absolutely be use something that's well-researched, well-evidence-based, and that works. There's so many people out there that think they're going to be super prepared, and they don't know what they don't know. They'll go on to Amazon. I shop on Amazon. I'm ashamed to admit. But if I go on Amazon, my criteria is that there's a 4.5 stars or better on whatever product I choose. So that's what I look for. And And if I were to do that today, you'll run across a Recon medical tourniquet, and it's like $10, and it's a knockoff from North American Rescue.
I'm going to look it up while you're
doing. And they have failed. They have actual failed tourniquets. And if you probably see it, and last time I looked, I think there's 12,000 or something like that, 4.5-star reviews. But there are cases where those tourniquets have failed, and that's a matter of life or death. So using a tourniquet that is recommended by the COTCCC is definitely the way to go, in my opinion.
And you know, with a lot of those Amazon reviews, many of them are bot reviews.
Yes.
And people don't realize that. Like, I think it's better to actually talk to people who have used it, who have gone hands-on.
Yep.
Recon medical tourniquet.
All right, so that's one. While you're looking it up, I'll run through the others. Chest seals. You should have a chest seal on you. As it turns out, we have more body parts than just arms and legs. So if you have a chest seal, you know, that can cover any wounds between the, I always tell cops, you know, between the neck and the belly button. Medicine doesn't have to be hard. So many people try to make medicine way more difficult than it has to be. I've always said that, 90% of medicine, even at my level as a paramedic, is common sense. That other 10% is exactly what you're talking about, getting that additional training, investing into yourself, investing into your community, investing into your future patients. Anyway, so the third thing that I talk about are the Raptor trauma shears. And the fourth was it medical gloves? I think it was medical gloves. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, you talked about one type of glove today that is actually a little bit more heavier duty than the standard nitrile gloves, right? One that you said actually comes up more like a gauntlet on the forearm. Was it possibly that?
No, it was, I just remember what it was. It was a combat gauze. So, or compressed gauze, preferably with a radio opaque line, which just means that it will show up on X-ray. Mm-hmm. So that can be used for a multitude of things. So you're a big EDC guy, and I am as well. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I like is to carry things exactly that. That's exactly what I would recommend. The thing is, that has multiple uses. I can make a sling out of that. I can do wound packing with that. I can just use it, to wrap somebody, that has a little wound or something. So there's so many things I can do with that little piece of, and that's what, $3, $3.50. Unless you want a hemostatic impregnated gauze, and that's about $40.
Yeah,
$40+.
In our austere med class, we talk about how you can even use like the packaging.
Yes.
Right. Yep. As a chest seal. You know what I mean? Like, and that's just thinking outside the box. Now. Right. So let's just jump back to Street Cop for a hot second. Then I want to get into your background some more. So what are some of the Street Cop bingo items? Now, I say this because if you go to SHOT Show, they say at SHOT Show, you're probably going to see a person in a tactical kilt, right? Put that on the bingo list, right? And at SHOT Show, you're probably going to see, the foreign investors, put those on the bingo list. So at SHOT Show, are there certain types of people or certain things that you're going to see that like all you guys, because we're in the vendor alley, we're not on the tables,
right?
But are there certain types of people that you're like, you're going to see that person here?
Oh, and I'm guilty of it right now, sitting here across from you with the 5'11 pants. I mean, everybody wears the 5'11 pants. That's got to be a bingo item.
It's like super 5'11 man, right? 5'11 pants, 5'11 polo with the radio.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. And genuinely, what's kind of neat about Street Cop is it really does attract the people that are excited about policing. And we want to encourage that because, especially in this day and age where some agencies may not be so supportive, even or the agency itself or the public isn't very supportive to the officer. There's so many officers that have showed up here, on their own dime, between the conference fees and the hotel fees, they're trying to invest into themselves and into the public. Every group has, the bad apples. I think I told you I provided medical care last year to a conference attendee that had a little bit too much to drink. But, for the most part, it's just everybody's super excited. And I'm sure you've been to a ton of conferences, mm-hmm. and I have as well, through the medical realm and that sort of thing. But what's different to me about this conference is the buzz in the air. Everybody's just so stoked and so excited to be there. And it's pretty inspiring, honestly.
It's got
to
be also the cinnamon buns. That was amazing this morning. Like, we're all
smart play by Dennis.
Seriously, like he knows cops, right? Cop cakes.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, he...
Power rings, for donuts.
Oh, my God. It was amazing. There was coffee. There were the cinnamon rolls. And then, he had the food trucks ready to go. Is it every year at the Grand Ole Opry? Is it always here?
So no. Last year we had it at the Atlantic City Resort, or okay. the Harrah's Resort in Atlantic City, and it was at the tail end of COVID.
Yeah.
The facility, you know, it was okay, but I think people are going to be a lot happier with the nightlife and that sort of thing here.
And that's one of the things too. Like, if you have a chance, like maybe you have to sell training to your loved ones, like sell it to your family, sell it to your wife, your husband, whoever. Maybe if you find a training event where you can say, look, I have to do this for 7 or 8 hours a day, but look, it's in Nashville. There's a lot of cultural right. things to do in Nashville. Like, while I'm doing this, why don't you go do this?
Right.
And then we'll meet up after we're both right. done. Like, I think that's really smart that he did Atlantic City, Nashville. Any idea right. where it's going to be next year?
Orlando.
So oh,
it'll
Jesus.
Be, yeah, it'll be in Orlando.
Go to Randall Knives right. in Orlando. Go to SeaWorld. Like, damn, that's smart.
So I want to bring up a quick point about investing into training.
Yes.
So we're in Nashville. So let's talk about the most recent active shooter yeah. deal. It was awful. But the officer that put that shooter down with the AR did a phenomenal job. You can tell he was well trained. And the guy's officer, or the sister of one of the officers, made a great post.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
she said every time he's gone from a family function, every time he's gone on a birthday, every time he's gone, you know, from this or that or the other thing, it all accumulated into this moment where it was needed the most and saved mm-hmm. lives. So I get chill bumps thinking about that.
Yeah.
It's like that. I showed my wife that. I mean, I think every wife, you know, my wife is very supportive, incredible woman. And I'm very thankful for her. But like most wives, they get a little bit frustrated. You know, I'm out doing this, or I'm out doing that, or I'm training, yeah. or whatever the case may be. But I showed her that, and I said, this is exactly my point. You know, I'm not trying to be mean, but this is exactly what I'm, you know, the point. If I'm ever faced with something like this, I want to know what to do.
Yeah.
Which, you know, not to try to translate or shift gears, but that's why I developed this course, the Life-Saving Medical Tactics for Law Enforcement. I developed that course because it's not fair for these officers to not know what to do. That's a sinking feeling mm-hmm. For them to show up on a scene and have, you know, that they drive 100 miles an hour there. They get there real fast, and that's real good. They put that thing in park, and then they get out, and then they're faced with this carnage. What do I do? And so my course is just solely designed to give a starting point of, hey, here's where we can start until we get those additional resources on scene.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. That quote about, you know, the investment and it paying off and whatnot. I think one of the reasons why a lot of people are resistant to train is because they say, well, you know, I haven't needed it, right? It hasn't happened. And that line drives me nuts, because
absolutely.
The other line that follows up is, it hasn't happened until it has, you know, or everything works until it doesn't.
My most frustrating one is, oh, well, I would know exactly what to do if that ever happened.
Yeah.
That drives me, you know, I do a lot of training for paramedics and EMT students, mm-hmm. and they'll mess up in the training thing. And that's fine. That's where you want to mess up and identify yeah. your deficiencies. I'm not perfect. I love training because I will find my deficiencies and be yeah. able to fix myself. So the point being, they'll mess something up, and they say, or they'll mess up really bad, and you can just tell they need some help, and they try to cover, or, you know, cover themselves by saying, oh, well, I'd know what to do if it was a real patient. Since it's not a real patient, I just get a little nervous.
You know,
it just drives me nuts.
One of the things that we hear frequently when people take like an entry level course with us, they say, man, I didn't realize people were going to be so open and willing to share knowledge. Like, I thought it was going to be more standoffish. And quite honestly, it's probably because they never trained before. I don't see that very often in the training circles. And I mean, I've trained with rival companies, if you want to call them rival companies, before right. I joined Fieldcraft. I mean, I went to multiple shooting schools. Every instructor was looking to make the student better, and every instructor was willing to give time. And if it's a reputable school, they're not going to employ right. someone who's going to let their ego get in the way and you know, create that air or that tension where students won't want to go.
Right.
I didn't feel any of that at Street Cop so far. Like, it seems right. like everyone's just willing to throw out the information, right. which is pretty damn awesome.
Well, so it's funny you talk about shooting courses. Mm. Not to plug this guy, but Josh Bedingfield with Prevail Shooting Tactics out of Oklahoma. I never met the guy before. I just recently moved to the area. He invited me to his course. It was the advanced auto pistol course. And same thing. He was very open. And he started out by saying he was very professional, had a great plan in place for everything. And he was very open. He said, I'm not going to withhold any information that I have because I want everybody, including myself, to be better. And I said, and that immediately, yeah. as an instructor, made me say, oh, I'm listening to this guy.
Yeah.
Because the guy that's like, oh, well, I've done this and I've done that and I have this war story and that war story, that's great. But where's the value?
Yeah. And when you meet an instructor who says there is only one way to do something, as opposed to here are many ways, find the way that works for you.
Right.
You need to reevaluate if that instructor is good.
Absolutely.
So now shifting from street cop to, well, kind of sidestepping from street cop to your involvement. Now, you mentioned that you are coming from the fire department side of the house, right? Fire services, medical services.
So I got my start in 1998. I went to basic training. I did the delayed enlistment program, and I went back to my senior year, and I hated high school. I mean, I could not do my senior year after coming back from basic. So I ended up getting my GED. And for those of you out there getting your GED, it did not hold me back. So then I went on from there, and I went to combat medic school. Back in the day, it was 91 Bravo before it became 68 Whiskey. And you talk about that. It's very interesting. Back in the 91 Bravo days, I could have stopped there and said, oh, well, this is what I was trained to do.
Yeah.
And at that time, they told us not to use tourniquets on folks because it would just kill, you know, they'd lose the limb. And, you know, 20 years of war has shown that that's just simply not true. And thankfully, they've done that evidence-based medicine, which I think is incredibly important for people to be teaching. So that's why you have to find reputable people that stay intact or in touch with the community to find out the latest evidence-based trends. So anyway, from there, I was actually in the Guard, in a Guard unit, and I transferred into the Air Force as an Air Force firefighter. And then I got out in 2005 and went civil service. And right now I'm at Tinker Air Force Base full-time as a federal firefighter.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, and like anybody in public safety, I have about five jobs. So from there, I'm assigned as a tactical paramedic to and deputy sheriff to Canadian County Special Response Team. And then just got commissioned with Seminole Police Department. So
that's fantastic. So yeah. Now, even though you didn't go through like the police officer training, you said that you were.
I did. Yep.
You did.
Yep.
You did.
So okay. In 2018, when I was originally with Oklahoma County Tactical Unit, and to carry a weapon, you had to go through the reserve CLEAT course, which is a law enforcement accreditation in Oklahoma. And so I did that. And so I am a certified peace officer in the state of Oklahoma.
Okay. Cause I was confused. Maybe in our discussion earlier, you said that you were still on the medical side, but you were.
And that my third job.
Yeah, exactly.
So I also work for Heartland Medical Direction. I'm the director of education, and we serve 160 agencies throughout the state of Oklahoma. And so we have about 5,000 medics or so that we serve for continuing education. And, medical direction, for those of you that don't know, even as a paramedic, all the training I have, I am nothing more than an extension of a doctor's hands. So anything I do medically, I have to operate under a physician's license. So any agency, even, here in Nashville, they have a medical director that reviews, that sets the protocols of what we can and cannot do, what drugs we can and cannot give. And then if the medics have a question or they run into something that they're not sure of, this is a physician they can call and say, hey, what would you like me to do here? So that's a Dr. Warden's role, but he also has a degree. He got, he had to have something to do in his spare time. So he got a master's degree in adult education and really focuses on delivering great quality education to all the people that serve, under the Heartland Medical Direction realm. And then separately, we received a federal grant for a SAMHSA grant to hold two EMT basic classes and two advanced EMT classes. I'm sure, as you know, most of Oklahoma is a very rural in nature. Mm-hmm. So getting providers or advanced providers to those areas is very difficult. So, so we're in the midst of doing those courses getting those providers qualified. And it's really been an honor to be a part of that team to facilitate that.
Now, with all the roles that you have, I know we talked a little bit earlier, you mentioned the first time or not first time, but one of the times that you had a call out and you had to drive at,
high speeds.
Yes. very, very fast. You had to drive very quickly to a scene. Do you recall the first time that call came? And do you recall like the feelings, the sensations of like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be doing medical care, but it's going to be possibly under fire. Like, do you recall that? Like,
yeah, in my military experience, I had some experiences overseas. That was the first time. And the biggest thing that I think the biggest piece of advice I even got just from the fire academy, from an instructor, just stayed and resonated was be calm. I think that's no matter what it is, no matter what training level you are, I don't care if you're the most, and of course I've never been a special operations person, but I don't care if you're a Delta Force guy, and I don't care if you're somebody, just fresh out of high school. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing and probably best thing you can do is take a moment, just take a breath.
Yeah, because your patient is probably going to be like, why are you freaking out? Right. Like, is it really that bad?
And so, you know, and there's studies behind that. There's physiological studies. You know, if you actually literally take that deep breath and just take a moment, that does so much for you as a provider, which translates to doing well for your patient or whatever the situation it may be. I mean, say you're in a gunfight or whatever else. You're like, well, Sean, you can't be doing deep breathing exercises in the middle of a gunfight. Or can you, you know, if you're doing a pursuit, I mean, they tell officers, hey, do some deep breathing, you know, calm yourself down. It makes you think more clearly. It relaxes you a little bit. You're making better decisions. And so I'm a big believer in be calm. You know, if you can do nothing else, at least be calm, you know, because you're physiologically going to make better decisions.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Ketone IQ. Yeah, this is a mid-roll break. We're talking about Ketone IQ, a product I've been using for years now. It's made by HVMN. And it's a product that I've been using because I do have traumatic brain injury. I also have a little bit of fogginess, but it could benefit everybody because it gives you the same clarity you would get when you're in ketosis. That ketone ester puts you in that ketosis state of mental clarity, and it's like caffeine without the jitters. I love it. So if you're interested in Ketone IQ, go ahead and go to HVMN. That's HotelVictorMN.com. That's Hotel Victor Mike November, HVMN.com, and use Fieldcraft, one word, to save 15%. Again, go to HVMN.com and save 15% off with the code Fieldcraft. Now back to the podcast.
Yeah, I'm not a scientist by any means, but I can tell you from like the diving perspective, you know, if you're trying to breathe really quickly, shallow breaths, you're going to use a lot of air.
Yes.
But if you take a long breath in and you breathe out at a long, you know, controlled breathe out, you actually use less air and you see more, you know, and same thing is true with like long range shooting. You know, if you're not breathing properly, you start seeing a blurred reticle sooner. Right. You know, so little things like that, like it's funny, like you're saying that, but it's reinforced through practices that we see elsewhere.
Absolutely.
So now getting back to that first call, maybe from overseas, it was different. But what about the first one domestically? Do you remember it?
Honestly, so I've been doing this for, I've been riding on the civilian side in an ambulance. I've been in an ambulance since 2007. And so the agency I worked for, we didn't run thousands upon thousands of calls, but we stayed pretty steady. We ran from about 12 to 18 calls a day in a shift. And so that's pretty steady. And I just remember it just all melds together kind of, you know. I'm there, of course, there's a few calls that stick out in your mind. I had a pretty intensive call, if you don't mind me sharing.
Yeah, please do.
I had a pretty intensive call during my paramedic clinicals. I was the very tail end of my paramedic program and right about to graduate. And this was in October of 2016, maybe. I think it's 2016. And we got a call. It's actually Halloween day. And we got a call for a woman bleeding in bed. Everything was very calm. It was in the early afternoon, about 4 o'clock. We go into this neighborhood. It was very, you know, no red flags sort of thing. I said, okay. You know, I was thinking like a GI bleed, you know, sometimes people bleed in their GI tract and that, you know, that's kind of what I was expecting. And a lady opens the door, did not seem upset. She said, oh, she's right back here on the left-hand side. And I walked into this room, and this lady was covered in blood from the top of her head. And she was covered with a blanket up to about her midsection. And it was like dried chunks of meat on her. And it was, I was like, what in the, you know, I was just shocked. And she was, her eyes were wide open and she's breathing, you know, hyperventilating. And I looked at my partner, and remember, I'm in a student role on this particular day, but, you know, towards the end of your paramedic program, they make you take the lead type of thing, you know, and you have your paramedic there. I looked at him and the first thing I did was checked her eyes, you know, and her pupils were equal and reactive. But I could not tell where she was bleeding from. There was it all dried. And she had been laying like that for hours, just, you know, doing that deep breathing and looked terrified. I mean, that really stuck in my mind. And, I told my partner, I said, do you think it's like psychosis? What? He's like, I don't know. It's like, where's all this blood from? It's very confusing. And I walked around the end of the bed and there was a dead body on the floor. And what had happened, her husband had shot himself and all that brain matter and everything had, had gone onto her. And so it was a very gruesome scene, obviously. And so we, my partner said, let's just get her on the cot. You know, so I get her on the cot. We take her out to the ambulance. And as soon as we get her on the cot, she starts having a seizure, which is indicative to us of maybe she most likely has some kind of a head injury. And so we treated that, you know, we treat her symptoms and, you know, we get her in the ambulance. My partner says, okay, let's do an IV. Let's, you know, get the her intubated, all those sorts of things. And so he said, we do a procedure called RSI, and it's not rapid sequence intubation. It's rapid sequence induction. Let's get that straight for any medics that might be listening. But anyway, so that's where you push a cocktail of medications and it paralyzes that patient and sedates that patient so you can get an airway, you know, established in the patient. And so anyway, he gets everything ready and he goes to push the medications. And I was going to do the actual intubation itself. And we hit a bump. The driver of the ambulance slammed into a curb and it did a traumatic disinsertion of her IV. And so right as he did that, it was actually pulling into the ER bay. The ER is fairly close. And it wasn't a big city. So it was a lower acuity IR.
Yeah.
Or ER, I'm sorry. And we pull in, we get the patient inside, and she's still hyperventilating. And you know, so the doctor says, hey, let's get her intubated. And so my paramedic partner says, hey, can my student do it? To his credit, you know, in the chaos of that scene, he, you know, I really respected him from an instructor perspective. He said, hey, let my student do it. And the doc was like, yeah, I'm fine with that. So I was all ready to go. I had my tube, I had my laryngoscope. And so as I'm, you know, I find the airway, I visualize it. They tell you that in school, and her mouth is completely dry because you know, when you're breathing like that fast for that long, everything's dry. And so I went to go insert my intubation or my endotracheal tube, and I'm try to get it in there and it's locked up. I said, hey, I need some lubricant. Usually use a water-based lubricant to lube the tube. And so it would not go. And so as this is happening, simultaneously, a nurse wipes the side of this patient's face where all that dry blood and everything had been, and she'd been shot right here in the cheek. So as she wiped off the face, blood started drizzling down. And so we knew that she, yes, had been shot in the head. And so, so anyway, I'm trying to get this tube in. I said, hey, I need a packet of, you know, lubricant, you know, another silly, tiny, weird thing to need, you know, in the moment. And they could not find one anywhere in that emergency room. The partner that the paramedic had ran out to the ambulance looking for one, could not find one. The physician said, you know what, I'm just going to go ahead and do a crike, you know, where they do a surgical opening of the throat and try to place an airway that way. And so he straddles her, this patient, and he's cramming this device in her throat. And I'm like thinking to my, and I'm just a student again, I'm thinking that does not look right. That looks all sorts of wrong. And it turned out that it was all sorts of wrong because he did not get the airway placement. As I went to go bag the patient, I had full resistance of the bag valve mask. And it was a futile effort. The patient ended up dying. And so I share that story because of this. You know, it's a call that sticks with me because I feel guilty, you know, in that it was a stupid packet of, you know, the lubricant. It's a small deal that should be with your airway stuff, you know, and, you know, being prepared and having that prepared mindset. I share that story. So any listeners that are medics or are police officers or are firefighters or are in a, you know, even a citizen that takes a, you know, the personal security and safety very seriously, don't overlook the small things because that literally killed somebody.
It comes down to staging, right? Like,
yes.
I mean, you look on like a Cat 7 tourniquet and there's a spot to write the time.
Yes.
Right. You look on, you know, the soft tee, there's a spot to write the time.
Yes.
And yet people will quickly buy the stuff that they see at the range or they'll get the advice like, hey, you need a tourniquet. And they take the advice of someone who's experienced, but they say you need a tourniquet, but they don't get the training with it. And the training would say you need a Sharpie.
Yes.
You know, and people forget that little detail that you have to scribe the time that you applied that thing.
Right.
But again, there's that little detail, right? That little packet of lubricant for that airway,
yep.
a Sharpie for the tourniquet. Let's stick with this idea. What other little details would you recommend for some of the most common things that are out there?
So, you know, the tourniquet, let's stick with the tourniquet for a moment. And you're exactly right. You should have three things with the tourniquet, in my opinion, the tourniquet, the Sharpie, but also if I'm reaching for a tourniquet, I'm also reaching for a blanket simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Hypothermia can happen. The hardest month to treat hypothermia in, by the way, is July or August, where it's super hot because people you're sweating, you're working on this person. It never crosses your mind that that person has lost their ability to operate, you know, their body temperature optimally. So they can become hypothermic. And if they become hypothermic, blood does not clot as well. And so keeping that patient warm, if you've sustained an injury bad enough that I say to myself, that needs a tourniquet, you're also getting a blanket. Mm-hmm. And that's something that a lot of people don't know. A lot of people don't think about. And I tell these cops, how hard is it to put a blanket on somebody? So that's one thing. Another thing about tourniquets, that's great. They're listening to this podcast. They're like, okay, Sean, you've convinced me. I'm going to go buy a COTCCC recommended tourniquet and I'm going to have it in my kit. Well, that's all well and good, but you have to take the tourniquet out of its packaging. Oh, Sean, it's gonna lose its, you know, expiration date. No, you have to take it out of your packaging because as it turns out, blood is pretty slick. And once that gets on your gloved hands, you're not wearing black gloves, of course. And now my fingers are slipping all over this thing and it's difficult to open the packaging.
One of the things that came up, I think we were talking today, or maybe it was another participant from Street Cop, the duct tape or the skateboard tape, right?
That's smart.
So the skateboard tape, that deck tape, it gives you that traction if you don't want this big flag on here. But I mean,
that's a great idea. I've not heard about the skateboard. I love learning things. Yeah, for sure. There I go. There's my one thing I learned.
Yeah, in the skateboard tape, I mean, we use it in the survival industry, you know, for an additional striker for like strike anywhere matches.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Or you use it on, you know, some guys will put it on their Glocks, right, for the slide whatever, right? Like if they don't have that accelerator, you know, for their support hand, they put it on the on the front of like the, just in forward of the takedown switch. But What else is there? So we mentioned tourniquets. Like, what other ways would you say, like, hey, if you have this, you should stage this with it?
I do a lot of with tourniquets because especially with cops, you know, the time strap is another big deal. You know, so we talk about the time strap. A lot of cops like to have the time strap over the windlass rod. And so because first of all, the Velcro, it piles their uniform or even civilians that carry it, it piles their stuff, you know, and tears it up a little bit. And they have to. So that kind of sucks. Well, the problem is if you're shot, right, if I lose complete use of my arm, you know, people do tourniquet training. You'll see that. So they'll elevate their arm like this. Mm-hmm. They'll put the tourniquet on. I know the audience can't see that, but imagine raising your arm up, you know, like you're like a zombie, you know, outward. And then they put the tourniquet on and I say, well, what if you're shot in that arm? You can't raise your arm up like that. Can you put the tourniquet on effectively? And so once they put it on, well, now they how are they going to twist that windlass rod if now I'm trying to get that fumble, and you know as well as I do that your fine motor skills, they go out the door unless you do intensive like SEAL Team 6 style, you know, Delta style training every single day of, you know, getting that, you know, muscle memory to flip that off, you know, and nobody does that. Nobody in cops aren't doing it. I'll just say it, you know, for the vast majority of officers, they're not doing it out there. So I tell them, you know, you have to have that that time strap hanging over the edge, the leading edge, mm-hmm. about an eighth of an inch. Don't cover the whole thing. Let it hang over about of an eighth of an inch because that's where you can actually grab it and actually apply it. What are the things that, you know, having access to things? I mean, you talk about EDC, you carry two knives, you know, you carry a knife on your, you know, non-support side or your support side rather, and your strong side. I mean, you want to have access to tools and equipment, right? And same thing for your tourniquet. You know, you're like, I'll carry a tourniquet and I'm going to carry it in my, I don't know, cargo pocket. Well, are you able to access that? Have you trained in accessing that tourniquet with both hands? Right. And so being able to access, it's a big deal. And I talked to a lot of people, you know, and I think your listeners would really benefit from having an ankle first aid kit. You know, you put it on and you forget about it. I mean, you notice it's there for about 5 minutes and then you don't even recognize it.
And chances are you're administering aid by taking a knee, which now means you're able to access it.
Well, and you know, what I like to do is I'll actually take the whole thing off. If I'm working on a patient, I'll actually take the whole thing off and I'll actually lay it on the chest of a patient. That way, all the things I need are right there. And that works well for me. So I have my tourniquet there, my quick clot right there, my chest seals right there. I have my, you know, and you talk about a Sharpie. There's a marker that's specifically for skin. Surgeons use it. I like to use that. You know, and you can use that again. I like the multiple uses. You can use that, you know, in a pinch when you need to write something down as an example. Or you can use it if I get bit by a spider or a snake or whatever. I can actually just trace the outline of that bite. And then that way, when I go to the hospital week, they can see how much that's expanded. And then I'll mark the time of that surgery.
Right, right.
So there's a lot more uses than just a tourniquet or something like that. You know, your weapon system. I mean, you know, I am not an expert on weapons. I am a certified peace officer. I've shot, you know, a lot. But having your weapon system cleaned, ready to go, you know, inspecting, you know, making sure your springs are, you know, taking care of your equipment that's going to take care of you. Yeah. I don't have to preach this to you. I mean, I believe that's what fieldcrafted survival is all about. You have to take care of the stuff that's going to take care of you or take care of others. You know, I think that's important.
There's two schools of thought with a lot of that maintenance stuff. Like I know friends who will say like, oh, I haven't cleaned my firearm in 10,000 rounds or whatever. Right. And then there are the folks that are like, I went to the range and I sighted in my rifle and I shot it seven times, like some low ball number. Right. And they're like, and I cleaned it inside and out. And it's like, you can clean it too much.
Yeah.
And then there's the other side where it's like, you don't clean it. And now it's not even a flex at that point. It's like, yeah, you're just dirty. You're pig pen. You're a slob.
Right.
And I get it. Listen, there are sometimes where just adding more lubricant, the lubricant and the carbon creates a slurry and it makes the gun run well.
Yep.
But if you just say like, I'm testing it to see how long it can go before it fails and you're still every day carrying it, it's like, is that responsible? And the same is true of your kit. Like you should know, when is the expiration of your kit? Like, is your kit all dirty? Is it dusty? Like,
I love that point. So a lot of people don't realize, you know, the medical equipment expires. You know, it comes with an expiration date. When I first got on the TAC team with one of my agencies, a lot of the operators would come up to me and be like, hey, is my stuff good to go? And I would look, and they still had the granule quick clot where it would have an exothermic reaction. And so I made a big deal and I went and got a cookie sheet and put some water on it and poured that on there. And of course it just steams up and they're like, their eyes get real big and I'm like, all right, so now we see why we have to take care of our, you know, look at the expiration date. So we've actually implemented, you know, with our SWATs, we do a 2-day TAC med school and we look at people's equipment, make sure the expiration dates are good. Make sure another thing to have that people might think about is a contact card or an emergency contact card, mainly for officers. I have them put it underneath their plate.
Yeah.
And it should have, you know, what are you allergic to? What kind of medical problems do you have? That exact thing right there that you just handed me.
For those of you just listening, right? Like I just handed Sean in case of emergency card that I've put up on an IG before, but it's like my date of birth, my blood type, current medications, allergies, and then two emergency contacts with the relation to those contacts, right? You don't want to just be like, hey, you know this guy Kevin Estella, like, you know, like they're you know, if you're calling one of my buddies, be like, oh yeah, Kev, I know him. Or if you call one of my sisters, you know, maybe you want to have a more gentle delivery, you know, like if something bad really happened. But you're saying stage it on their, like, well, on their carrier?
And so I suggest officers, now that they can do it or not do it, but I suggest they put it, if they have a plate carrier or a, you know, put it behind that plate, you know, and there's a commercial one available that has like a little pull cord, like little paracord type of deal they can just pull out, and it might be red or whatever the case. It doesn't have to be long and huge, but you just pull that out and then they have all that information. That's just another thing that, you know, especially for an officer or in a profession where, you know, you could get hurt or a civilian, you know, it's super helpful to me as a medic. If I arrive somewhere and I can have this information presented to me saying, hey, this person has no medical allergies, or they do have medication allergies. It's very helpful to know that. Or here's the medical problems I've had, or here's my emergency contact information. I love that you have two different people, because I have an out-of-state number. I live in Oklahoma. I still have my Georgia number. I had, you know, 15 years ago. I'm just never, I've never changed it. So when I call somebody, nobody answers the phone. And so, you know, having all that information in there as a quick access to say, hey, because that drives my medical decision making. Mm-hmm. Hey, if they have this medical problem, hey, maybe this is where I should start if I don't know what's going on.
Now, let's get into some of the best practices, because we already made reference to street comp. We made reference to your background. We made reference to some of the problems of practice that people have. But now, if we were to examine some of the ways that you could offer advice to help an officer survive a traumatic experience, loss of blood, loss of limb, whatever it is, let's go into some of the details of like, hey, this is some of my current best advice. And then after we do that, I want to kind of pick your brain on a couple of like the most pressing issues in law enforcement today with medical treatment. Like, we'll get to that. So okay, like what are some of your like survival 101 for cops? Like, hey, here are three things you should be doing if you're not doing them already.
Let's see. Carrying more medical equipment on your person than just a tourniquet. That's my number one. Have it on your person. It's an officer survival thing. If you get you get hurt more places than just on arms or legs. Number two, seek out training. You know, I ask cops all the time. I said, hey, when was the last time you went shooting at the range? And they say, mm-hmm. Oh, I was shooting last week. And they're very excited about it because cops like to go shooting. So that's awesome. Okay, when was the last time you shot or that you practiced with your tourniquet? Oh, last year, like 2 years ago, or I don't remember. So that is absolutely something we talked about training again. It yeah. all comes back to training. So yeah. if you're going to the range, anybody going to the range, you should also take 5 minutes. It doesn't have to be a forever long thing. Take 5 minutes and do a couple tourniquet drills. And then when you say, oh, I can put on a tourniquet, I'm just fine at it. Well, I have a video of Las Vegas officers. I shouldn't have said that. But I believe it was Las Vegas, I guess. They did have a tourniquet on them, so that was good. But you could tell they had the when they applied the tourniquet on this person, on the suspect, it was, you know, inside out, and they just, it was kind of a mess. You could tell they hadn't trained as proficiently as they had with their firearm. And I believe that's been fixed. I know some Vegas officers now, and now, you know, thankfully, people are starting to see the value of medical training. So get training, right? Okay. That's my second tip. My third tip would be, let's see, quality versus quantity equipment.
Okay.
That would be my third tip. You don't buy the stuff off Amazon. Go with a reputable manufacturer. I believe it's North American Rescue that gives, I believe they give a law enforcement discount.
And if they don't, they should.
Yeah. There's Contingency out of Texas. That's a company I work with. They actually put together our kits for street cop training. And they actually are partnered with North American Rescue. Mm-hmm. They're phenomenal. Tactical Medical Solutions, phenomenal folks. Boundary Medical, great people. So there's the top ones I guess I would recommend right out the gate. There's another company, MyMedic. They're gonna hate me for saying this, but they're proud of their RATS tourniquet, and I just can't believe they're trying to peddle that. It's just not an effective tourniquet.
Speaking of a tourniquet that you have to move your arm to apply to yes. yourself, right?
Well, and the other thing is, you know, I get people, you know, really fighting back on that. It's great in the fact that you can make it real small and people like that. It's super, you know, EDC friendly. The problem with it is, would you carry a high point as a duty weapon?
Oh, hell no.
No. Well, it's the same theory. That's a high point
unless,
to tourniquets.
Unless it's the yeet cannon.
Right. Does it work 10% of the time? Sure. Yeah. You know, but does it work, you know, as effectively as the rest of the, again, COTCCC evidence-based tourniquets do? No, yeah. It does not.
It's like you ever hear that expression that firearms are comforting. They're not meant to be comfortable.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like that's it. So now, something that I've heard a few cops talk about recently, and we even talked about in our booth today, exposure to various drugs, right? Mm-hmm. Fentanyl.
Oh, I love this topic.
Okay, and I want to end on this because I figure it's going to yes. be the high point,
yes. right?
No pun intended, high point. Nice. Again, if it's the yeet cannon, that's awesome. I love the fact that they named it yeet cannon based on people's votes. Okay, so exposure to fentanyl.
Okay.
What are some of the myths about exposure to fentanyl, like in feel free to go off.
I love it. Thank you so much. Let me take this and move it a little closer.
Yeah, you
go. So it's actually a part of my course that I teach. The biggest myth is, you know, cops are trained and over and over and over have been told, if you get just a speck of this fentanyl on your person, you're just going to die. You're going to immediately just die. And so people freak out about it. They see it and they have a vasovagal, they have a panic reaction, right? They panic. And so I call them the fainting goat cops. Not to be mean, but that's that's what happens. I mean, you know, it's an exact equivalent, right? And so, you know, what drives me nuts is the industry that come out with these fentanyl resistant gloves, you know, because they can charge more for them. And it drives me insane. I think it's, you know, super shitty. I'm sorry. It's just shitty that they're doing that. Because your skin is fentanyl resistant. If I slathered both, this is an actual study. If I slathered both palmar surfaces, just the palms of my hand, slathered it with fentanyl that's designed to go through my skin. It's actually designed because I have fentanyl patches for pain and all that sort of thing. If I slathered my hands in fentanyl, okay, both hands, it would take 14 minutes to get a 150 microgram dose. And that's from the American College of Medical Toxicology. These are doctor people. This is not Sean speaking to you. This is the American medical toxicology people that study this. They're doctors and experts in how medicine goes into the body or drugs go into the body. You know, you have different routes. You can ingest it. You can inhale it. You can, you know, you can have, you know, dermal absorption, all these different things. But as it relates to cops, just looking at a speck of fentanyl on your skin, it's not going to kill you now. Do I recommend wearing gloves when handling this? Of course I do, right? Let's not be silly. That's a common sense aspect. Back to the black gloves, right, for cops. I tell them, don't throw away your black tactical gloves because I know it'll make you sad and your department's probably invested thousands of dollars for thousands of boxes of these things. So go ahead and keep them, but use them when dealing with fentanyl, right? Because that's that white showing up on the black so you can see it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, searching people's nasty cars.
What do you think the reason is why, like, you see these videos of cops that have these reactions?
Again, people have that, you know, they encounter the drug fentanyl, right? They see that it's fentanyl. There was a case recently out of California, somewhat recently. This trainee was with his FTO. You can see him. He's bagging up this fentanyl and there's a device that they used and it popped. Yes, it is fentanyl. And he just kind of locks up and falls back, you know, and there's this big PSA. It was put out by the sheriff's department, by the sheriff himself. And he said, oh, this was, you know, due to a fentanyl exposure and it was a big deal and yada, yada. And it was interesting because 3 days later, the American medical toxicology people that had doctors came on and they refuted it. And they said, no, this is not because of the fentanyl. He's having a panic reaction. And that, by the way, that particular deputy in the research had like three previous episodes where he had fainted like that. And so it was a panic reaction.
Mind over matter.
Yes. I mean, I'm not blaming the officers or the law enforcement personnel involved with these reactions. It's just, you know, you're told something's going to kill you. And now you're confronted with it and your system's overloaded.
And you know what? People experience this all the time. They go to the dentist, right? They go to the mm-hmm. doctor's office. We host blood drives regularly mm-hmm. and people are like, I'm really nervous. And their heart rate is elevated.
Or needles. They hate needles, right? Yes.
Mike. Okay. So here's a great one, right? I love telling these stories. So when I was a teacher, we used to do blood drives at the high school mm-hmm. and sometimes the kids would pass out just from the finger stick.
Right.
Right. Or sometimes, I'm joking about kids passing out. Meanwhile, like I passed out back in October after fasting and I ended up on the ground and the guy was like, did you pass out? Or he's like, are you okay? I'm like, oh yeah. Did I pass out? And it was the funniest thing to me, but he's like, wow, when was the last time you ate? And I'm like, yesterday at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. He's like, you're supposed to eat in the morning. I'm like, yeah, but I'm on keto, you know? And right, he's like, you're an idiot. I'm like, I know, it's okay. But no, like, there are people that will pass out or their heart rate will get elevated. Or mm-hmm. if a doctor walks in the room, they don't say a word, but it's like, oh God, here's the news. Like it's the anticipation is sometimes worse than the news. Yes, so is that kind of like what we're talking about?
Yeah,
here?
It is.
But elevated, right?
Elevated,
because, because now we're dealing with something that people would associate with death, where it's like, second time I'm bringing up diving. First time I ever dove with sharks, I was like, oh my God, there's a shark. And then you dive with sharks a few times and you're like, they're just checking you out, right? Like looking at you. There are times where you're like, oh crap, like maybe we should all huddle together, you know, that type of thing. But my God, like the first time you fear what you don't know. And I think with fentanyl, especially, there's so much that's still coming out about it. People, or there's bad information being spread.
Right.
And people are like, holy crap, I'm going to die. And they pass out.
Right. Now, not to say, you know, in medicine, you know, you never say never, right?
So
say you're chasing a suspect and they have a kilo of heroin and they throw it into the air and it's a windy day and you go, you take a big breath in, maybe, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's an exception to every rule, but the point is, you know, in your typical routine handling of, and in the report of the American Toxicology, they say, you know, incidental exposure to fentanyl is highly unlikely to cause any sort of, or anything near opioid toxicity. And that's the experts talking. It's not Sean, again, it's not Sean's opinion. It's not my, it's, I'm going off the latest evidence-based researchable facts. And you talk to anybody in the medical field, it's a big eye roll, you know, mm-hmm. and again, it's being pushed out and pushed out by these back to Dennis's thumbprint, back to the thumbprint that you to make it full circle here. You know, it's like the thumbprint, if you will, of our modern police training is this fentanyl's bad. Fentanyl's bad. Yes, it is bad if you inject it and, you know, overdose on it. There's a huge opioid crisis, but that's not what cops are doing. And the other thing for cops or people listening that, cause now you can carry Narcan just as a regular civilian, you can access Narcan in my state in Oklahoma. You can email these folks and they'll send you a whole Narcan kit for free. They don't care who you are. So my point about Narcan is Narcan only works on opioids, you know, somebody's having a meth overdose or, you know, benzodiazepine overdose or whatever the case may be, the Narcan's not going to work because it works on a different, key or lock site. I always say the drug is a key, okay, and the receptor site is a lock, and that key will go into the lock and then, you know, unlock at night, you get your desired effect. Well, the Narcan only goes to that one certain lock. It's like if I were to take your rental truck keys that you have for your awesome little Nissan out there and try to open my hotel door, it's not going to work. It's not the right key for the right lock. And so that's how drugs work within the body.
What's the likelihood of someone who doesn't have training being able to recognize the difference between, say, like a meth overdose and a, like, say, fentanyl?
Well, I'll give you a great resource right now. It's pupil size. So as a person awake and talking to you, you'll hear these officers get on the radio and they'll say, I need fentanyl. Or, I mean, not fentanyl. I need heroin. Gosh, not heroin either.
Jesus.
I need Jesus, right? It's been a long day.
Yeah, these officers need Jesus.
I need Narcan now, right? And if they're talking, right? If they're talking, they don't need Narcan. So the biggest thing is pupil size. You know, somebody who's unresponsive or not breathing at a very reduced rate, and their pupils are pinpoint, full send on the Narcan. If their pupils are bigger than pinpoint, it's not going to do any good. And that's the easiest thing to remember and to do. And so if you just look at that pupil size, if you take nothing else away from this portion of the conversation, it's pupil size and rate of breathing. If it's slow breathing, small pupil size, they're very pinpoint. Yeah. Give them some Narcan.
What's the craziest thing that you've seen? Let's end on a high note here. Craziest thing you've seen after taking away the high of someone by giving them Narcan? Have you ever seen someone wake up and start fighting?
People get, you know, a lot of vomit, you know, and, you know, as a medic, and not to sound bad, you know, I definitely try to treat my patient well. My only goal as a paramedic is to get their respiratory rate up. It's not to wake them up. I only want to get their respiratory rate back up. And that's my other advice for people. Mm-hmm. Now, for the people that, you know, getting the kits, you know, that's 4 milligrams. And so it's not like you can control the dose as I can on the ambulance and, you know, where I can give it via IV. But my only goal is to get them breathing again.
Right.
And then you have to watch them because, you know, some of this stuff is really potent. And so it can actually come back in, kick the Narcan out, basically say, hey, it's my turn again. So that's why you're giving two doses with the Narcan. It's just people fighting and throwing up and that sort of thing.
All right. So now, where can people find you if they have questions? Where can people find you if they want to learn more from you, learn more about Street Cop, all that great stuff?
So I got to look at my phone. I always forget if it's Fire Medic or Fire Rescue 183 at Instagram or Sean at streetcop.com. Just S-E-A-N at streetcop.com. And it's Fire Medic, F-I-R-E-M-E-D-I-C 183 on Instagram. And then my full name, Sean, S-E-A-N. Barnett, B-A-R-N-E-T-T-E on Facebook.
Fire Medic 183.
Yes.
Well, you got a new follower.
Oh, nice. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I just got it too.
Awesome. Well, Sean, thank you so much for this podcast. And, you know, I hope you enjoy the rest of the Street Cop seminar and hopefully we'll be able to, get the word out of what you guys are doing. Cause it's pretty awesome to see that, Wonderful. You know, and I always say that we're big supporters of the boys in blue, boys and girls in blue. And, it's pretty, pretty amazing to see that community come together and, awesome. And see the folks that really want to be the leaders in that community. So thank you so much for what you're doing.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
Hey, thanks so much. All right, guys, this has been the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. Please check out Sean and all the folks at Street Cop Training, and see you next time.